Matt Segundo here, finally back in the saddle. Although I suspect in the case of this week's guest, a saddle doesn't really apply. Unless, of course, there's money to be made in saddles. I wouldn't know. I'm still reeling from the Academy Awards. Shocked. Flabbergasted. It's enough to drive any sensible film lover to suicide. But if the truth must be told, I once made a bad investment in a saddle company in the late 1980s. The tip came from a gentleman who was dressed in a clean blue suit, who told me that Urban Cowboy was a misunderstood film and that America was set to rediscover this film's merits. He told me that there was a secret market in thoroughbreds, so I slapped down my meager savings and lost my shirt, my hair, and my self-respect. I suspect this is why I'm so very interested in this week's guest. This week, our young roving correspondent talks with Liz Pearley. She is the author of the book, Money, a Memoir. It is a book I read with keen interest, only to find that there are no hot investment tips between the covers, but I suppose that's okay. There is a good deal of thought about women's relationship with cash, a subject I find of great interest, but I won't tell you why.
Hi there, I am here with Liz Pearley, author of Money, a Memoir, and I want to go ahead and be completely clear on that. It's Pearley, not Pearl, so for anyone who is picking up the book, be sure to know that there's that lay there. How are you doing?
Great. I'm glad to see you.
Well, first off, at the beginning of this book, you mentioned that you sort of keep a quiet contract with cash. Now, there is, of course, a denouement to this book, but I'm wondering how much of this contract is still in operation today, even after sort of the sort of strands of resolution?
Well, there's the, it's sort of like a building, you know, there's the stuff that goes on underground and then there's what you get to do on top on the surface to make it look good. Mm-hmm. I think deep down that quiet contract's probably still in force. I just don't act on it as much anymore. Mm-hmm. That quiet contract that tells me that someone else will love me by taking care of me financially. Well, that's not true and I don't act on that anymore, but it doesn't mean it's not still in me.
Okay. Now, I wanted to go ahead and get the terms clarified, both for me personally, but also for our listeners. You refer to money as power, and now I read the alternate interview that you did, and you mentioned the power translated into independence, freedom, the ability to make your own decisions. And I kind of wanted to sort of get that sort of clarified, because if you're talking about like a career or a vocation that involves like a lot of cash, the more cash you have, the more sort of responsibility to your home life or your family life you might give up. I was wondering if you could kind of clarify how one can has responsibility that transfers into personal life, or whether how one can get a, how a woman can get personal independence because, you know, the odds are sort of stacked against her. You know?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, if you make your own money, you can make your own decisions. Mm-hmm. And unless you forfeit that right for some reason. And why you would forfeit that right is very complicated, and it does happen. But when I came out of college and started working and started making my own money, I started making my own destiny. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of a better definition of power than being able to choose your own life.
Mm-hmm. So you say you see money predominantly as independence, what you would say.
It sure buys a lot of it, you bet. If you don't have to depend on anybody for where your meal is coming from or to put the roof over your head or your kids' clothes, then, you know, you can have a lot of freedom.
But what if you are, say, you know, to go into, like, say, a law kind of industry, and you are, like, sort of a senior associate, and you have all these billable hours that you have to sort of satisfy with, but you are getting a very good salary for that. So with that kind of thing, then, you know, but anyone, whether man or woman, is going to be giving up a good deal of independence to sort of, you know...
Oh, but there are other forms of power. I mean, there's social power. Those people go on to buy big homes, mm-hmm. and drive big cars and have big 401ks,
yes.
and be influential in their community and give money away to charity. And, you know, that's another form of power.
I guess what I'm trying to get at here is sort of like social power versus financial power and the trade-offs that particularly a woman might have. I kind of want to sort
of... I don't know that it's any different for a woman or a man in that situation. I mean, yes... When you work, you give up X hours, and mm-hmm. the more hours you give up, often the more money you make. Mm-hmm. And that's an individual decision based on your appetite for cash And the fact that some people actually like practicing the law. I'm not one of them. I like to work, and indeed, I can't imagine a scenario in which I wasn't working. Mm-hmm. In part because of my mental stimulation, but everybody's different on that. And, sure. And I would hate to generalize on that one between women, men, and among different kinds of women, because there's some women who work very hard, just never get a paycheck because they're working in the home.
It's interesting you mention that, because did you read the New York Times review of your book?
Oh, I did.
Yeah, I figured you did. But Ariel Levy pointed out that... was it that review, or was it something else?
Oh, no, that was the only really bad review.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, that was the only bad review.
Huh, I think it was. But I'm not sure if it was that review or something else that basically sort of suggested that he was saying, I see here that, you know, he was saying that the specifics of your circumstances in terms of the divorce remained murky, and that also, I believe, he said that...
He was a she. He was a 20-something she.
Okay.
And she had... wanted me to write a different book than I wrote. Mm-hmm. That's tough because I didn't write that book. I don't believe in clubbing people over the head with my personal finances. Indeed, I think when you get into this, I make $20,000 and you make $200,000 mm-hmm. kind of pissing contest. What you do is divide people instead of unite them. And I think women intuitively know that money is the great social sorter. Men know it too. We use it to different ends, I think, because mm-hmm. society, no matter what we say, still values a man for his money and a woman for her other things as well, like her ability to be beautiful or reproduce like a bunny or keep home or whatever. So, you know, when you're talking about murky circumstances, I think she wanted me to lay out exactly what my divorce settlement was, exactly what my bank balance was, and I think that's divisive and unnecessary, and indeed I think it's part of what keeps women so silent about money. So she kind of didn't get my point. Mm-hmm. Oh, well.
Oh, well. Can't win them all.
You know, in books, you pay your money, you take your chances. Everybody's allowed to say whatever they think.
Well, I wanted to get into this definition that you coined in the book of the emotional middle class, which is very interesting. You define this as actual and desired lifestyles not bound by economic abilities. And yet there's some very interesting examples you have in this book. You have the attorney who lives in a condo that she can't afford. You have Karen, who overextends herself financially. You note, of course, that 40% of women lie to their partners about the cost of something, which I found to be an astonishing sort of statistic.
I think it's low.
Yeah.
I think those are only the, you know, fools who stand up and admit that they're lying.
Yeah, yeah, very, very true. But I guess what I'm wondering is if there is sort of a minimum best, meaning that, you know, a lot of the sort of complaints from the woman in this book seem to be about, like, you know, buying lots of clothes, having like sort of a kind of conspicuous consumption sort of situation. And I guess, is there a way to sort of respond to that conspicuous consumption by sort of saying, well, you don't necessarily have to put your kid in the top sort of, you know, preschool, or you don't have to necessarily have the condo that you can't afford?
I just picked some big examples. I mean, it happens on a small level every day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't need to be making a lot of money to get into a lot of debt.
Yeah.
And we have a society that's addicted to its credit.
Yeah.
We had negative savings in 2005 for the first time since 1933, and the only other time there was negative savings was 1932. If we look back in history, these were not great times economically in our country. So here we are with negative savings because we are spending so much money. And we are spending money arguably because we want to purchase a kind of lifestyle.
Yeah.
And that lifestyle, you know, I had one person say, oh my God, are those Manolo Blahniks? And I'm thinking, no, actually the shoes I'm wearing are from Payless and they were 2 for $39. But the fact that somebody would think that I was wearing a certain kind of shoe elevates me to a certain kind of status. And it's very purchasable on an economic scale, except for at the very top end where you're dealing with brand names. So people buy cell phones with videos in them. People have these, the number of kids, I teach in the public school system sometime, and the number of kids who have $200 sneakers on their feet just stun me.
Yeah.
So this is not, it's no longer bound by income, this economic middle class, this emotional middle class. We're trying to purchase a way of being, an emotional way of being with hard, cold cash. And in the process of doing so, and it's the middle class because we're reaching to the luxury at the top, mm-hmm. but we're putting ourselves at very real jeopardy of falling into the impoverished at the bottom.
Yes.
So it's a way station between true bankruptcy, and mind you, more women declared bankruptcy than went to college in 2003, than graduated from college. So we're talking about something that's very prevalent. So it's a way station between that kind of impoverishment and the luxury that, you know, who doesn't watch Cribs that I know in my kids' class in high school? They all love that stuff. And the $5,000 chrome wheel hubs and all that stuff. And the women with their who pays $500 for a pair of sandals? I'm sorry. But anyway, that's my judgment. But anyway, we've mortgaged ourselves into this emotional middle class to buy a dream of a life. And in doing so, we're letting emotions create financial situations, and that is the road to ruin.
Well, I want to tie this in specifically to women, and the thing actually that you kind of touch upon briefly in your book in terms of the appearance, which goes back to sort of the Naomi Wolf beauty myth kind of situation. But one thing I think that is just not really sort of out there and needs to be out there, and is, and even in your book it's kind of hinted at but not really sort of exposed, is besides the fact that women make two-thirds the salary that men do, upon average, there is still the cost of maintenance that we just keep disguised, of like how a man can wear the same suit twice to a function and a woman is not permitted to do that. I was wondering if you had like some, you know, thoughts upon this and how this kind of applies to what we're talking about here.
Well, I have two suits, but we'll leave that aside. The fact is that there are two very different ways, and this is the first book I wrote. It was called When Work Doesn't Work Anymore. But
yeah.
There are two very different value systems that are like operating systems within women these days.
Yeah.
One is the I go to work, I become fulfilled intellectually, I make money. The other is I am a woman, I want a family, I want a husband, I want a beautiful home. And we are rewarded for both. There's a brilliant woman named Jolene Godfrey who counsels parents on raising financially fit kids, and she gives this very perfect example. A boy who is mowing lawns is told he's very industrious. Mm-hmm. A girl who is babysitting is told she's good with kids. These are, to me, the kernels of value systems, the really epicenters, if you will, of two value systems that are absolutely not compatible, but are absolutely contiguous. Mm-hmm. They live next to me. They battle for space in my soul. It happens all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, also, there's the notion of guilt as well. And guilt is sort of, you know, through all these testimonials and your own testimony, is one of these themes that is kind of unfurled through the various stories. I guess, do you have a solution as to how women who have these materialistic or these impulses to sort of extend themselves or mortgage themselves into oblivion, you know, is there sort of a way to kind of say you can in fact live within your means, or you don't necessarily have to have X number of things, or, you know, is there a way to sort of like, you know, to kind of tell society that, you know, women don't have to, you know, extend themselves beyond the realistic sort of expectations they have, or that it's actually okay to live within expectations?
You know, that's not my role. I am not going to tell anybody how to live. God knows. But what I really do urge is that people do what they do consciously. And, you know, I spent so much time worrying about money and so little time doing anything about it other than making it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same with food. I spent so much time worrying about my weight and so little time doing anything about it. And that creates a situation of guilt and of disempowerment. I hate that word, but unfortunately I don't have a handy substitute. But, you know, it takes away your power when you feel anxious and guilty about the fact that you're not performing up to your own expectations of yourself, or that you might be inadequate about something, or that you aren't taking care of something you know needs to be taken care of. It just eats up so much of your life when you do that. I am not a self-help writer, oh God. I am not a financial expert. I'm just an honest person,
yeah,
in a sense. I mean, I just said, look, this is me, warts and all. I do this. I've spoken to 200 women across the country plus, more than that, who do this, we have this guilt around the fact that we know we can do better in this area. And we need to examine, for each individual person, why we don't.
But there is this common sort of theme of guilt, and I guess I'm not, telling is perhaps not the right verb here, but maybe exposing is.
What woman wasn't told that you don't talk about money, it's not polite?
Yeah.
You know, it's a great dictum. And indeed, I never forget this one friend of mine saying, never count your money in front of the poor. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, how humiliating that I would even do that and put another person down. You see, women, and this is one of those great generalizations, but it's a generalization because it's got a lot of truth in it. Women will, if you put a group of women together, find the common ground. They are not hierarchical beings. Money is a tremendous social sorter. It will divide people very quickly when you're dealing with absolute terms. Men will look at money in terms of hierarchy and where they stand in some sort of pecking order from the alpha to the omega. Women don't do that. And so women feel guilty when they have something that another woman doesn't have. They also feel a little, you know, pride, of course. Believe me, women walk in the room and the first thing they do is size up what everybody's wearing and how, yeah, you know, good they do or don't look in it. And that's a different form of social sorter, but we will all find common ground if we can.
The interesting thing in this book that I found interesting is throughout the stories and then the testimonials that you actually dug up here, you described all the women as Claire, a tall, stunning brunette in her early 30s, Barbara, a trim woman in her early 60s. I found this to be kind of interesting because even in sort of analyzing or unfurling this particular problem, we're sort of still dealing here with aesthetics. And I'm wondering, is there some sort of aesthetic underpinning here that really...
That's so interesting. It never even occurred to me, but it would be a shame to describe Barbara as a woman with thinning hair with a skin condition. I mean, it wouldn't make her a very sympathetic person.
What if you just said, like, you know, Barbara, you know, describe her by her occupation or describe her by just Barbara is this person who happens to be in her, you know, in her 60s. I mean, it just seems to me that it's interesting that there's these qualifiers here in sort of trying
smart. I never thought about that. You've set me back here. I'll have to think about that some more. That's a very smart observation. No one's ever made that.
Huh. Oh, well. I was concerned because you mentioned you're very concentrated and fixated upon appearance in this book during the early sort of the first 100 pages. And it seems to me that that kind of sort of ties into what we're talking about like the kind of keeping up with the Joneses kind of mentality of, like, you know, the shame of being the poorest sort of family on the block.
No, I think I talk about a lot of women in the book without that. I mean, people who were, you know, the sixth out of seven children. I mean, I talk about family position as well. But I definitely do describe, I definitely describe people by if they're attractive, I tend to throw that in. Yeah. I guess I think it makes them more appealing, so there you have it. What can I do?
I don't know, but I mean, at the same time, they're telling their story, so shouldn't their words sort of stand alone? I mean, that's...
Oh, yeah, you've got to describe women to other women. You know, you got to locate them in time or space, otherwise they're just sort of headless horsemen.
I don't know, but they're sort of their actual testimonials would sort of, I guess, tell their story. I mean,
I think I do that as well, though. I don't know, but I think you're very right. I mean, there are places where I definitely describe people not by what they've cooked during an interview. But, you know, people like, you know, I changed her name at the end. I almost just used her real name. This young woman who's 33. Mm-hmm. I describe the restaurant where we're sitting. I'm not actually describing her. I mean, I just try to locate people in identifiable ways so that people feel they're approachable characters, because when I'm talking about some of this behavior, it's not always the most, it's not everybody's best side, which is why people really wanted to remain anonymous. Mm-hmm. So my tendency is probably always going to be to make something approachable about them. I don't think I describe anyone as a unbelievable knockout with Manolo
boogers hanging out of their nose.
Yeah. Or, yeah, conversely, yeah, somebody with, you know, really bad dandruff.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's go into talking about marriages and relationships in this and how money is kind of used as a form of control or perceived as a form of control, and how men and women sort of, you point to very specific ways that men and women both deal with money in this. But common ground, I guess, I want to sort of talk about. It seems to me that a lot of the kind of fiscal dilemmas that we see in the marriages in the books, They're not necessarily resolved by trust or talking them out. I mean, you personally actually managed
certainly
to kind of...
Certainly was my personal story, was.
Yeah, in your personal story you do. But a lot of the women who have these sort of problems dealing with their husbands in the book don't seem to be able to, I guess, confess their feelings about money, or at least have some kind of acceptance of certain sort of materialistic sort of impulses. And I was wondering...
Well, some of that is you've got to figure out which chapter I'm talking about. If I'm using them to prove a point that's already in the chapter, I'm not necessarily focusing on the people who did figure it out. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, some of them do resolve very nicely in the book.
Well, there's the one really extraordinary sort of example of the artist guy who gets his wife pregnant, and he wants to be this artist and becomes the architect, which I found that to be a very sort of extraordinary example where, yes, on one hand, you know, he's not being responsible towards taking care of the marriage, but at the same time, you sort of see the chasm of, like, well, he has this option and she does not, in terms of, like, pursuing kind of a, I guess, free or liberated kind of independent kind of occupation.
There's a lot to unfurl there. Let's see if I can make some headway. Number one, in any relationship, someone's going to take on the role of the responsible and someone's going to take on the role of the irresponsible. And that can flip back and forth, but mm-hmm. you rarely have like two responsible people marching off into the sunset together. Mm-hmm. It's kind of gender blind. This is one area where sometimes the women will be much more concerned about retirement than the men will be. Or conversely, a man will sit there and say, I cannot believe you bought a handbag for X amount of dollars when we could be putting that in the kids' college fund. So it is gender blind. It's equal opportunity neurosis. You could go back and forth. Money is power. Well, basically, there is no right or wrong solution about money. Sometimes when I interviewed people, there was one couple who had big political differences, and he was sending off money to the National Rifle Association, and she was sending off money to the Democrats, and they both decided that for the sake of their marriage, they should probably have separate accounts and a house account so that they didn't have to look at this behavior that they knew was in their spouse but was not going to be solved because they were just of very different points of view. And they found a very peaceful way of doing that by having a house account. My husband and I decided to throw everything together. Even though, you know, right now I'm making more money than he is. That may not always be the case. But we communicate very regularly about all this. I mean, I have a laptop right now which is inserting equal signs into everything I write, so it looks like Morse code. And I said, you know, I really do have to buy a new laptop. He goes, well, all right, but we also have to paint the house. So we have a discussion around what's going on with our money. We try and sort of work it out that way. In places where the woman earns much more than the man, I was on the phone with somebody today in Chicago who was telling me that, you know, she felt badly because she had just, her company had gone public and her stock options had turned out to be worth, you know, not a fortune, but enough that she can take the year off and be with the kids. And her husband's very unhappily employed. And she felt badly because she knows he's depressed because it's a traditional role reversal. And I mean, each one of these, I'm giving an example on all, you know, Northeast, South and West, because you can find an example, and the key to making it work in each one of these is to value the other person beyond just their financial contributions. And that takes some maturity. It really takes, in the places where I saw it worked, two things were involved. Maturity, because of this valuing of the other person in a non-monetary way, and communication. You got to have joint expectations. There's a great guy named Stephen Goldbart who I interview in the book. He's the head of an institute in Marin called Money, Meaning, and Choices. And he does a lot of work about creating values for the second half of your life that incorporate your finances. So you really do together decide what's important to you separately and jointly and figure out how to afford it. And that's the ideal.
Near the end of the book, you actually make some very interesting comparisons between women who are younger and women who are older and how they view money. I'm wondering if you have any sort of thoughts on how you can possibly communicate to women in their 20s that, you know, there are more sophisticated ways to look at money, or there are, you know, ways that you don't necessarily have to be nervous about some of these impulses that you have. Is there an outreach solution here, or is the book it?
Well, I think that's really what propelled me to write this, is mm-hmm. that I saw in my nieces and the people I loved a sort of fantasy around this emotional middle class. There's a story of a man who drops $75,000 on his daughter and then tells her, now you're financially independent. And, you know, horror of horrors. Now what he's done exactly is the opposite. Mm-hmm. He's given her the message, even though for him money is love and providing for her, he's given her the message that money is love and someone will provide for you. Instead of saying, hey, money is money and you got to make it and you got to be free to make your own choices and you got to take care of yourself and I love you and I'll help you. But you know, one of the ways of helping people is to make sure that they really, really understand the financial consequences. Women are an astonishing percent of the impoverished elderly, 87% a couple of years ago. Women leave up more than $500,000 on the table by not negotiating that first salary as aggressively as men. Women pay $1 million mommy tax by taking care of their children. We have huge financial penalties because of the roles and proclivities with which we play in society and with which we approach money. And we have to be cognizant of all of that, or else we end up broke and old and alone. And nobody, I got that bag lady shuffling down the alley fantasy. Nobody wants that.
Yeah. But to subvert this sort of, gender structure, there needs to be some galvanizing impulse to sort of, I guess, encourage young women in particular and women in general to have to take initiative, to take kind of control, or at least find the impulse within themselves to sort of, make these kinds of controls and say, look, I should get paid as much as a man does for the exact same position.
Right. It doesn't happen if you're not aware of it.
Yeah.
And I wish that I had a neat little three-step solution. As an ex-publisher, I've foisted many of those on the public. I know they don't work, which is why we continue to sell self-help books. But there isn't one. But I'll tell you, there is one universal imperative, and that's awareness. If we don't know we're making financial decisions based on our emotions, if we don't know that there are hidden value systems acting as silent navigators directing our course, I can guarantee you we're not going to end up where we want to have as our final destination. Mm-hmm. So that's really this awareness, this cognizance of what you're doing. Then you have some choices about how you act and what you decide to do.
I guess it becomes an even sort of greater sort of solution in this kind of, I guess, reactionary climb where, something like the Equal Rights Amendment wouldn't even be considered, which is just, it's such a totally different change of pace from 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And I guess my question here is how we can possibly get the message of awareness out in an environment, particularly in a political environment, that is extremely discouraging of that message, or at least even wearing blinders about that message.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we have a country that seems to be determined to reverse social progress at the moment. I'm not qualified to talk to this point. I have many private opinions, but
sure.
They don't really relate to.
I guess I'm just trying to find a sort of more socioeconomic angle to the issues you raise in this book.
More women are going to college than men right now. More women are graduating from college than men right now. Women, it's no longer a question of are women going to go into the workforce. Women are in the workforce. I mean, we are making that's warp speed change. In my lifetime, it's changed. I mean, my grandmother wouldn't think of going to college. My mother went to college and worked and then dropped out to raise me and then died. She might have gone back to work.
They're also taking the gap in math and engineering. Women are catching up now.
Yeah, I also, that's just one measurement. That's like continuing to measure the gross national product on manufacturing. I'm not so sure that that's a criteria anymore. I think that, you know, what's more of an issue is that women are at some point, and men, going to have to wrestle with the structure and form of work and compensation, because we still live in these rigid environments that were designed for men in the 1950s with women at home to take care of them. And this is like sending up an astronaut with Tang. This is just ancient history.
Well, you point out that this particular sort of hierarchy, it has not sort of shifted in relation to the fact that, 71%, I believe, was the figure in your book, of two from the Red Book study of all families are two income families.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a huge
proportion, and a third of those, the women earns more than the man now. Yeah. These changes are happening. You can't deny them. They're categorical. In terms of I think we've gotten very sidetracked, maliciously so, by the whole mommy stay at home debate. I think that's a hideous horror show foisted on women to divide them. I refuse to engage in it, because I think it's nonsense. And what I do know is that the other day I was in a meeting, and there was this disembodied voice. I was down at TiVo, because in my day job I do, you know, kids ratings, nonpartisan kids ratings for a nonprofit. And I was down at TiVo because they were interested in what we were doing. And there was a disembodied voice, male, on the speakerphone. And at a certain point he said, you know, my wife can no longer engage my 6 and 8-year-old in Home Depot. I'm sitting in a parking lot outside. I really have to leave the meeting now. And I thought, wow. 10 years ago, you wouldn't hear a senior executive at an up-and-coming company make an admission that he was sitting parked behind, you know, a Chevy Tacoma in the parking lot outside of Home Depot with his wife amusing his kids while he tried to do business.
Yeah.
I thought, good on you, buddy. You know, good on you. And that's the kind, it's a small example, but the more people in positions like that do it with, like Katie Couric the other day, I was doing the Today Show. She said, you know, I'd love to stay and interview you, but I have to do something at my kid's school. Mm-hmm. You know, these are value shifts, and the more we shift that value, the money will follow.
Okay. Oh, the other thing that was interesting, going back to this whole sort of, like, is it okay to be so-called miserly? Like, there's the woman named Shelley in the book who declares and nervously states, I am the target of an IKEA queen. Personally, if one is happy at a certain income level, I don't see anything. There's nothing necessarily wrong with Target and IKEA, and yet this kind of hesitation exists for the good life. Again, I kind of just, you know... I'm sort of fixated.
Whether you need to buy a sofa with new pillows, or whether you need to be doing something else with your life that you're distracting yourself by buying a new sofa and pillows. That's all.
Yeah.
You just really need to know what's going on.
Sure.
Because no sofa is going to solve other emotional problems.
That's true. But I mean, I guess what I want to sort of say is, why can't women just ignore the catalogs? I mean, you don't have to sort of men and women, too, by the way, you know.
Yeah, when is that a female thing?
Exactly. You mentioned like the catalogs that are often sifted through by these particular stories, but I mean,
because we're taught to value ourselves by material expressions, mm-hmm. often, you know, the car you drive, the coat you wear, the sneakers on your feet. We live in a very material society.
What of the single mother of two who may work as a barista or something? What can they sort of impart from your book? They may not have, if you're working minimum wage and you like have, you know, you're trying to support kids, then you are in a whole different sort of ballgame where you don't have
right
these options.
Right up front, that the tyranny of choice is a pale shadow in the face of the tyranny of need.
Yeah.
You know, I almost stopped writing this book because of that.
Really?
Yeah, because I felt like, God, who am I to be talking about this when there are people out there who are being kicked off welfare rolls, who, you know, have no shot at an IKEA catalog, and that is an intractable, hideous social problem that needs to be addressed. That is not the audience for this book. I won't even pretend it is. I am talking about what I call myself, a member of the club of disposable income. Mm-hmm. I have a credit card. You know, I make a decent salary. I pay most of my bills on time. I can make some choices. When you are putting food on the table and struggling to pay the rent, you don't have choices. You do what you need to do.
Yeah. And for those listeners who would like a good book on that, there's David K. Shipler's The Working Poor.
You bet. Yeah. You bet. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there are good books on that. I have a brighter, more educated soul than I should write that book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No, I actually remember telling my publisher, I'm sending the money back. I'm sending the money back. Who am I? This is a whining woman's book.
Every sort of, you know, social strata has some sort of valid kind of story behind it.
I know, but look, if you really unpack it, though, I mean, you look at the guilt that people have about money.
Yeah.
You know, I can't imagine a less sympathetic book than, you know, Larry Ellison writing about his financial problems because he spends too much. I mean, who cares? Everyone thinks you should know better. Well, that sort of Chinese box can be said at any level of the economic scale.
I mean, same thing with like David Denby's like American Sucker from like a couple of years ago, which was a preposterous memoir, I thought. But at the same time, well, I can't necessarily judge it unless I've actually read it. And maybe these are valid problems to some degree, even though, well, you know, does it affect the population?
But as long as you've got, you know, the have-mores and the have-lesses and the have-nones, you know, you're going to have that kind of hierarchy and guilt attached to it if you've got a conscience.
Yeah. You titled this book a memoir, but it's also sort of part sort of sociological and... I'm wondering, what do you think? Why do you categorize this book as a memoir?
Well, because it's a memoir about money. It's not a memoir about me.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's about remembering money, and it's about remembering the money in my life. I asked myself, you know, if I put money at the center of my life and told my story, what would happen? Mm-hmm. If I really looked at an X-ray of the financial motivations behind my marriages, my work, my relations with my father, with my family, what's the truth there? Mm-hmm. And I just tried to tell the truth. As unappealing and as unattractive as it is in certain places, I tell some embarrassing things about myself.
Yeah. Okay. But good for you.
Well, I don't
but,
know.
But yeah.
Well, I don't know if it's good for me or not.
Well, I mean, good for the effrontery there.
I will say this, is that every woman who has interviewed me at the end has gone off the record and said, oh my God, this really made me think. And that's all I wanted.
Yeah.
You know, I have a lot of informed questions. I have very few answers.
I will say on the record that actually before I even talked to you, after I read your book, I actually talked to several of my friends of mine who are women, and I asked them, what are your thoughts about money? I mean, it really got me sort of thinking, too.
Oh, good.
You know, I mean, it's again, you know, a chasm that I think needs to be addressed.
I had the funniest thing happen. A man called me up and said, is this my quote about something? And I said, well, no, it's not. I mean, I don't think I interviewed you or your wife. There are people I know. He goes, well, I said that. And I said, well, I don't think you're alone.
Really? He tracked you down and called
you? No, it's someone I know well.
Oh, okay.
And he thought he had said this to me and that I had used it. And I actually know where it came from. It came from my cousin Danny. So I knew exactly who it was in this case. And we'd had somewhat of an argument at the dinner table with his wife. But it's so identifiable. It turns out we have such a narrow range of behaviors around some of this. It's interesting.
Well, I think materialistic impulses can apply across the board, no matter what sort of station of life or situation you're into. Well, Liz, thank you very much.
Well, I'm delighted to actually talk to a man about this.
Yeah,
it's interesting to hear your questions. They're different, and it's interesting to see what the hot spots are for men.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tell it soon.